Thank you very much indeed for those very, very kind words, and thank you all for coming along this evening. A special word of thanks to the canon law students who have been enduring purgatory to the point where they will certainly merit a plenary indulgence. On the area of authority and obedience, in all honesty, I have taught a course in Rome at the license level on authority and obedience every 2 years for quite some time now, and finished a course on that just before I came here. And a few weeks ago, one of my colleagues saw me in the coffee bar and said, "What are you teaching today?" And I said, "Authority and obedience." And he said to me, "Nobody wants to hear anything about that today." So I said, "Thanks very much." Unfortunately, he's right. Let me try to situate this question. I'd like to focus the question, in all honesty, on authority and obedience in the church, and therefore to relate the question also to conscience. And in order to do that, I think it's worth calling to mind the situation, first of all, in the church as we see it at the moment. There is, at this time, a considerable attention being given to the idea of conscience, the more emphasis being placed upon the role of personal conscience. That's what people seem to want to say. And associated with that, there is an increasing criticism of what are called merely abstract moral norms. There is an urge for us to come down to grassroots and look at the concrete reality of the world in which we live. People say you cannot live morals without doing that. Some of them then invoke the slogan that was the slogan of the Young Christian Workers Movement and the Young Christian Students Movement before and during the Second Vatican Council of See, Judge, Act. And that was also an approach, for example, to the social doctrine of the church, which sought to look at questions of social morals from an inductive perspective. In other words, to start from concrete questions and reality and problems, and then, in the language of today, discern how best to move forward. So many people want to return to that kind of way of dealing with morality. We have heard in recent weeks from the Cardinal Secretary of State, Cardinal Parolin, talk of a shift of paradigm in morals, in moral teaching, and in moral theology. Cardinals, Secretary of State, are diplomats and not moral theologians. The concept shift of paradigm comes from T.S. Kuhn's study on scientific revolutions, and it was incorporated into the area of morals by Scheffler and into moral theology certainly very strongly by people like Klaus Demmer and Franz Boeckler. But a shift of paradigm, meaning that scientific data in the strict physical sciences are such that the way of understanding scientific reality is no longer capable of coping with the new data which emerge, and therefore there needs to be a new paradigm to understand and integrate the new discoveries. This is something which can be understood in a strictly natural science context. It's much more problematic in a social science context, and it's even more so in the area of morality. Nevertheless, it is associated with claims which have been made in recent times. Not, they're not entirely new by any means, but there has been some attention to them in very recent times. People have been criticizing, for example, the concept of what they call intrinsic evil. I would prefer to call it intrinsic moral wrong. The concept as such, many of them don't like. Others say that too many acts are categorized as intrinsically evil or intrinsically immoral and need to be reviewed. But the question needs to be posed, if that is so, on what basis would this be done? It is not enough that somebody simply makes a statement, not even that some pope might make a statement, because morality and moral truth cannot be a matter of simply changing what we say according to the will of whoever happens to sit on the cathedra of St. Peter. Otherwise, we would fall into the philosophical chaos and moral chaos that was inaugurated, I have to admit it, by an Englishman called William of Ockham. Voluntarism, simply what I want and decide, becomes morally normative, decides what is morally good and right, is simply untenable. So that will not do. If there is a claim that we should shift paradigms in moral theology, then it seems to me that that is a concept, I think it's inappropriate for moral theology, but the closest theological concept that comes to mind would be that of development of doctrine. However, as the Dominican priest we were fortunate to be able to hear the other day said, quoting the key point of reference for development of doctrine, Vincent of Lerang, doctrine which develops must still be consistent with what it was. He distinguished very, very clearly between a change of doctrine which implied a denial of what had been proposed doctrinally and an authentic development. So if we are told that there is to be some kind of development of moral doctrine, this needs to be demonstrated to us very clearly by those who are proposing it. In other words, they need to show that there is authentic development without the denial of the key core doctrinal truth that is at issue. And that would be true, as true, of the concept of intrinsic moral wrong as it would be of any other concept, any other moral truth. This is a matter of strict moral obligation upon moral theologians and upon all pastors of the Church, including the supreme pastor of the Church, the Pope. It is not something that can be canonically constrained, but it is a major moral obligation because it is the duty of the magisterium not simply to teach doctrine, but where a doctrine could appear to be a contradiction of something already taught, to show quite clearly that this is not so. If we move then to the context in our world at the moment, we have to admit that morally speaking, we are under pressure from various sources. Internally, the pressure can come from what we may call emotivism. Sometimes we are so wrapped up with our own ideas and preoccupations that we do not judge things correctly because we are subjectively biased, prejudiced, do not see the reality in its proper context, and so forth. We are subject to hedonism. We like to do what gives us pleasure, and sometimes that is the only moral compass of some people. Very often, we do what is simply convenient. But none of those things correspond to doing what is good and true and right. None of them correspond to what St. Thomas Aquinas said when he said that the good is to be done and is to be pursued, wrong is to be avoided. That is the key distinction in all moral discourse, and that is a fundamental question of moral truth which cannot be set aside. Externally, we are under pressure from sociological trends, from conventionalism. Well, Father, it can't be wrong to fornicate. Everybody does it. Adultery isn't wrong if your wife has become ugly and you can't stand looking at her anymore. Everybody steals by not working for what they earn. These are real pressures upon us in a negative sense that we need to recognize in conscience, identify and combat as we strive to live a life that is orientated to the good and to what is just and virtuous. We are in a world that is still dominated by the rationalism of the Enlightenment, and by a consequence of the preoccupation of the Enlightenment with individual freedom. In moral theology, in the Catholic context, that means theories of moral autonomy pushed to an extreme. When this is associated with a focus upon personal conscience, it can all too easily lead to a short circuit, namely, I decide with my reason and my freedom what I think I should do, and nobody is to tell me otherwise. My conscience is all that matters. Unfortunately, people then often quote the Second Vatican Council. And one of the most wonderful passages of that council in Gaudium et Spes 16, which speaks about conscience as a sanctuary, as that sacred place, that secret place in which man finds himself alone with God, where the voice of God echoes within him, calling him to do what is good, to avoid what is evil, to love God and neighbour. And where that council then goes on to say that even in the case of at least invincible ignorance, conscience does not lose its dignity. People are much less likely to turn to another document of the same council in which, in Dignitatis Humanae, the decree on declaration on religious liberty, conscience is associated with the urgent and fundamental pursuit of truth, and where freedom of conscience is articulated also in terms of religious freedom, but not only, to enable people to pursue what really is true, to embrace that truth and to live by that truth. And in that same text, further on in paragraph 14, it is stated quite starkly, nobody can be acting in good conscience if they ignore the certain teaching of the Church's magisterium. Nobody can be acting in good conscience if they treat that teaching as a mere opinion. On the occasion of the 20th anniversary of Humani Vitae in an allocution to a Congress of Moral Theologians in Rome, John Paul II quoted those two points of Dignitatis Humanae 14 and added a third. He said, nobody can be acting in good conscience if they prefer their own opinion or the opinion of theologians to the certain teaching of the Magisterium. Said in the context of Humanae Vitae. Pastoral pressures. The best way to try to get you to understand perhaps what I mean by pastoral pressures is to tell you what happened to me many years ago when I was an assistant priest in a parish in Leicester. One day my parish priest came back, it was in the morning, and he said he'd been to get his engine filled. And he said, when I was there, I met this man, completely mad. He's a non-Catholic, he said, but he's absolutely mad. He wants to talk about something to a Catholic priest, so I've told him to come and see you, which I thought wasn't very a great compliment. Unfortunately, the man came, and then he sat there, and he told me that he had left his wife, and he had taken up with a young lady who was 20 years younger than he is. He told me the whole thing. And I said, yes, that's interesting, oh, what a shame, and things like this. But I made no other comment. And he said, well, what do you think about it? I said, I'm very sorry for you. He said, but what I'm doing is right, isn't it? And I said, no. And he said, how dare you tell me how I should live my life? And then he said, you're not even married, are you? And so I said, no. He said, well, you're not normal. You can't live without sex. So I said, well, actually, you can live without sex. I've done so all my life. I said, but we haven't come here to talk about me. And I'm not telling you what to do. You wanted to speak to me. But if you want me to tell you that committing adultery is morally right, we can sit here till midnight and I will not say it because it is not true. Now, it is very easy when people are telling you their pastoral problems and their real problems, it's very easy to become sucked in and to become unable to speak to them, I don't mean aggressively, but truthfully. To express genuine compassion for them, for their circumstances, and for their difficulties, and yet to try to say to them, this isn't really the best way forward. Why don't we try to look at it in another way? It's too easy to give way to the pressure, the pastoral pressure, to be merciful and compassionate in a false way. Let's then look at authority and obedience, perhaps, in this context. Very, very, very briefly, it seems to me that authority needs to be categorized, and I think it can be categorized into three different groups, there can be three different categories of authority. There can be and needs to be what we might call natural or moral authority. Someone I once knew, a priest of my diocese who's now dead, said that that's the only authority that counts. Now, he's wrong about that, but he's right to say that it does matter very, very much. What do we mean by that? Certainly we mean people who are sincere and people who are coherent. They're coherent. What they say is what they do. The way they live does not contradict their affirmations. So we can think, for instance, of Jesus in the synagogue at Capernaum. And people were amazed because he taught them with authority, not like the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, Jesus did teach with absolute authority, but he taught there with absolute natural or moral authority because Jesus never contradicted himself. He never failed to live up to what he said. And the Pharisees recognized that, and so at least the people recognized that, and some of the Pharisees did. But it is fundamentally important, just to give you an example, if you think about the pastors of the church in a very, very difficult age, the scandals that have been created by clerics sexually abusing minors, and the inadequacy, serious inadequacy, of many bishops in many places over many years has done untold damage to the church. And it has done untold damage to the moral authority of many bishops. Some religious sisters in Ireland told me that their local bishop used to call into them from time to time, and they enjoyed seeing him, and they were talking to him about some political issue in Ireland of a few years ago, and they said, "Why did you bishops not say anything more?" And the response, unfortunately, but credibly, was, "We have lost all credibility." Well, I can understand that people have lost a great deal of credibility. But people who have mitres on their head need to open their mouth to proclaim the gospel. And the moral truth demanded by the gospel, even in difficult times, even when their authority has been undermined. Another level of authority is what we may call technical authority. Here I have in mind the kind of authority that we respect and need to respect in people such as doctors, scientists, master builders, people who have very specific competence. And we respect them because they know what they're talking about in their field. That is enormously important. It's also important in the church. Appointments need to be made also with regard to people's capacities and competence. Otherwise, we have the wrong people in the wrong places. An appointment in the church of a bishop or a priest or anybody may be perfectly valid, but it will do untold damage if the person is incompetent or worse. The third category is what I call official authority. That is the authority that comes from holding a particular position. So there is an authority that belongs, for example, to the president of the ITI, so that when he makes certain statements, people know that they're important because they're spoken by, they're proclaimed by the president. And they know, therefore, that if somebody else says them, then that's just wishful thinking. If the president says that, then it's something that is going to happen, and it's got its real significance. In the church, the authority of the various pastors of the church is inextricably linked to the authority of Christ. And the authority of Christ is unique. Absolutely unique, not just because he was authentic, because he was consistent and coherent in the way he lived and convincing, therefore, in what he said, but because he is the Son of God. He and he alone is God made man. And therefore, when he speaks on the Sermon on the Mount, he speaks with the authority of God. Even to say that what God had revealed in the Decalogue in the Old Testament was inadequate. If you live like this, you will never get into the kingdom of heaven. In other words, if your justice goes no deeper than that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never get into the kingdom of heaven. You have heard how it was said, but I say this to you. And that is to establish a norm of moral truth, of justice, of a way that is necessary to live if we are to be converted and to believe the good news, if we are to be authentic, faithful disciples of the Lord. And it is that authority that is shared by the pastors of the church. If anybody asks you who is the head of the Catholic Church, I hope you will have the courage to answer unhesitatingly and without qualification, Jesus Christ. The Pope is the vicar of Christ, but he is not God. In considering authority and obedience, we have to take into account the reality of the history of our church. And there have been times when we have had the most appalling bishops. There have been times when the church has been bedeviled by clergy who are seriously, profoundly ignorant. And that was one of the reasons why the Reformation made such headway. We have seen times in the past when there have been corrupt and utterly immoral popes. In such a case, they lack all moral authority. They still have official authority. But what does that boil down to? It means saying of such persons, isolated persons, do what they say, but do not do what they do. Their authority there is analogous to that of the Pharisees, almost. It undermines official authority if people do not live up to the vocation to which they are called. St. Thomas Aquinas was and remains of profound importance in this discourse. St. Thomas Aquinas said unswervingly, we must do good and we must avoid evil. He did not say that there were so many grey areas that we could not tell the difference. He did not say that there is no such thing as intrinsic moral wrong. If there is no intrinsic moral wrong, it must mean, that sometimes genocide is legitimate. Cannibalism, slavery, paedophilia, and so on. That giving to the poor is not always obligatory. That corruption is not always immoral. I do not believe that there is no such category as intrinsic moral wrong. Our Catholic moral theological tradition has always taught that there are things that are never justifiable, no matter how good the intention, and no matter how pressing the circumstances. So if we want to use the inductive method of see, judge, act, judge demands that we look at the objective moral truth that must be applied to those circumstances. If we don't, we lose our moral compass altogether. It is not true that moral norms, or laws more generally, are always abstract. It is absolutely not true that they are matters of Pharisaic legalism. I do not believe that Paul VI, Pius XII, John Paul II, or Benedict XVI were mindless, legalistic Pharisees. I do not believe that for one minute. When St. Thomas Aquinas spoke about justice, he categorized it in three groups, and the first of these, in question 58 of the Secunda Secundae, was general or legal justice. Many of us have, I think, certainly in my case, listed the various categories of justice without always contemplating what it is they signify. But the answer, it seems to me, it has dawned on me in these latter years, is this. General justice is legal justice because we need law as an instrument of justice. Otherwise, we won't have justice. If we don't have law or moral norms that apply in different situations that are similar, then we operate on the basis of our prejudices and our preferences. We are radically inconsistent. We cannot develop virtue because we reduce our moral life to a whole series of atomistic reactions. And that is totally inadequate. Thomas Aquinas knew that. It is impossible to become good by doing what is immoral. It is impossible to become just by doing what is unjust, or to become chaste through unchastity. Moral truth means clearly distinguishing between moral good and moral wrong, justice and injustice. And that must not be sacrificed. Our obedience is to imitate the obedience of the one who was supremely obedient, Jesus Christ. Jesus, as man, gave full and perfect obedience to the Father in the Spirit on the cross, even though, as a human being, he asked, my God, why have you forsaken me? But in the garden, through prayer, he did obey with every fiber of his being. And as the letter to the Hebrews puts it, he learned to obey through suffering. And in the end, his prayer was heard. That kind of obedience is obedience to God and to what is perfectly good, and to the implications of authentic love of God and perfect love of neighbor. But it was not blind obedience. Jesus did not exercise blind obedience. And I would suggest to you that in conscience, blind obedience has no place at all. Why? Thomas Aquinas, again, taught us and teaches us that acts which are not voluntary are neither morally good nor morally bad. So if we don't know what we're doing, we gain no merit. Obedience must not be blind. It must be knowledgeable. And if St. Thomas is right, as he most certainly is, that moral norms or moral law are an ordinatio rationis, an ordering of reason, and he would say rationis recte, of right reason, then I would say obedience must also be an ordinatio rationis recte. We obey knowingly and willingly what is authentically morally right, what is objectively morally true. And if we want to speak about discernment, accompaniment, and integration, that can only be properly done in this way. The first discernment and the constant discernment that we must always make is between good and bad, right and wrong, just and unjust. We may never discern that it is right to do wrong, or to encourage or approve or accompany somebody else in doing wrong. I would suggest to you not to accompany me ever around Vienna. We are all likely to fall into the Danube and drown and be integrated into the waters of the Black Sea. In other words, discernment means following somebody who teaches authentic truth. And authentic truth in the Catholic Church cannot deny revealed truth, cannot contradict definitive teaching. In my opinion, it cannot contradict the constant teaching of the magisterium of the Church when it commits itself to stating that something is always and objectively and intrinsically morally wrong. If it were to do so, it would not, in my view, be authentic magisterium and would have no binding force in conscience, quite the opposite. Therefore, we must discern, and we must accompany those who lead us in the truth of Christ and of his Holy Catholic Church. And in doing that, with a conscience that is not mere freedom or autonomy pushed to extremes, but is the constant seeking and embracement and pursuit of what is true, in that way, and only in that way, can we become virtuous, good, and holy members of the people of God. Thank you very much.